As we wave farewell to the old year, with regret or relief as the case may be, that's the traditional tune which will ring out in raggedy chorus from many a Hogmanay party. Surely, though, there can't be many of us who've heard it in the Chinese version. But then, here on Outlook, we do try and bring you the unusual as well as the newsworthy. That found its way into a special edition from China. But whatever the language, the sentiments couldn't be more appropriate for introducing this final outlook of the old year, when we pause to remember just some of the hundreds of people and places we featured in 1985.
When I was very, very young, I was adopted by a marvellous couple that I know as my parents. Adoption is really quite a very, I think it's quite a marvellous thing, because it's given me a life that I would never normally have had.
When I was a little boy, you know, it was a guy who used to walk down the streets playing a washboard. We call it a rubboard in my hometown, and his name was Bama Lama. And he would be hollering, Bama Lama, woo, you shall be free in the morning.
It was snowing, and I was wearing running shorts, Hong Kong thong rubber sandals, T-shirts, stuff like that. I had a suitcase full of this stuff. The customs man went through my collection of Australian clothes. He looked at me as if I was trying to smuggle Hong Kong rubber thongs into Britain.
I've had no experience, obviously, with the present generation, but if you were negotiating with Gromyko, which I have had some experience, he's now the president, if you were negotiating with him, you were always very clear where he stood, and what is more, he wouldn't give an inch.
Some people in Addis knew me, but not in any of the provinces, really. Except all the kids call you sister, sister, because you're a European female, and of course their experience of European females has been the sisters of the various aid agencies, so they're always hoping you've got an Oxfam biscuit tucked in your back pocket.
A look ahead at some of the people we'll have the pleasure of meeting once more. And I should say here that you'll be playing your part in the proceedings too, indirectly. That's when we reveal who was judged to be, from the number of letters you sent us, the person of the year. Of course, there'll be many who won't shed a tear at the passing of 1985. Amongst them, the people of Blackpool, that holiday playground on Britain's northwest coast. Tourism usually brings them about £250 million a year. And in case that doesn't sound very much, let me point out that it's more than the Greek mainland and its islands put together earn from tourism. This year, Blackpool got the blues.
Well, they do call it breezy Blackpool, but this year things have gone a bit too far. More and more people are just staying away, and those who come often end up wishing they hadn't.
It's awful.
Terrible. Terrible. It's not so bad, the rain is so bad, but it's the rain that wets you through. Yes, hoping it will be finer at dinner time.
We'll go home at lunchtime. We come for the day, but there's no point me staying here with the weather being the way it is.
And on the beach, it's the poor old Blackpool donkey that's getting the worst of it. It seems no one but no one wants to ride in the rain, which is bad news for the donkey owners like Jackie Barley.
Well, the weather's been absolutely terrible. It's put everybody off. I mean, who's going to come to Blackpool when weather forecast, gale force winds, rain, hail, we've had the lot.
What's it been like for the donkeys themselves?
It's been really bad for them. You know, they get fed up in stable, they get on beach, that's it, they're running off, bucking, messing. You can't earn a living when you get down with them.
Tucked in behind the big seafront hotels are hundreds upon hundreds of small guest houses which form the backbone of Blackpool's tourism industry. Like the Blackpool donkey, the Blackpool landlady has a special place in North of England folklore. The image is that of a rather stout woman, hair in curlers, offering good home cooking without the frills. But bookings are down by 30% this year, and landladies like Janet Fallows are very much at the mercy of the elements.
Never seen weather like this. Me visitors coming in wet through, I can't even go out at night. They've got no dry shoes.
Does that make it difficult for you? Do they tend to take it out on you a bit?
Oh, yeah. It's harder work for me, because if the sun was shining, they'd be out. I wouldn't see them all day.
With me little stick of Blackpool Rock, along the promenade I stroll. In the ballroom I went dancing each night. No wonder every girl I danced with stuck to me tight. Every day, wherever I stray, the kids all round me flock. A fella took me photograph, it cost 1 and 3. I said, when it was done, is that supposed to be me? You properly mucked it up, the only thing I can see is me little stick of Blackpool Rock.
Gathering opinions in Blackpool, John Molson. Another person who seemed to be taking a rather gloomy view of things, at the outset anyway, was the Member of Parliament and former Prime Minister James Callaghan. He came in to discuss the prospects for the summit in Geneva during November between President Reagan and the Soviet leader, Mr. Gorbachev.
I think that there's been too much hype about this meeting. Neither side is in a position to enter into arms agreements, which are very technical and highly complicated and complex and need much more working out than you can give them in a few hours at a summit meeting in Geneva. I don't think that we should expect much more than atmosphere, a promise to meet again, and I would also like to see them give definite undertakings to negotiate in some areas, both on the regional problems and on arms. But there was one good sign, I thought, and that was that they're not making any public statements. The bane of international conferences, frankly, is when you make a speech or talk to each other and then immediately run away and tell the press.
What's your experience, then, of negotiating with the Soviets?
I've had no experience, obviously, with the present generation, but if you were negotiating with Gromyko, which I have had some experience, he's now the president, if you were negotiating with him, you were always very clear where he stood. And what is more, he wouldn't give an inch. He would go on and on and on. I've missed my plane when I was going for a very enjoyable weekend in Leningrad because of his insistence until we absolutely got to the last point and he saw he couldn't move me one step further. And I was as obstinate as he was stubborn. We were both there together. And eventually, we were both very hungry. It was getting late on a Saturday afternoon and we finally agreed. But I will say this to the Russians. On the whole, when you negotiate with them and reach an agreement, they keep the agreement they've made.
Mr. James Callaghan, one of the major figures of the century on the British political scene. A big man physically, too. But even he was dwarfed by the generous physique of Mr. Teddy Waite, the Archbishop of Canterbury's special envoy. That gentle giant whose style in negotiating for the release of hostages in the Middle East has earned him, I think you'll agree, worldwide admiration. He recalled his very first trip to Libya.
I went with an open mind, determined to try and meet people in leading positions and to try and listen to them and listen to what they had to say and what they had to tell me about their situation.
What was their response to you when you first arrived?
Extremely courteous. I was very well received because obviously it was known because of the preparation that I was an envoy of the Archbishop of Canterbury who is recognised, of course, as a spiritual leader and not primarily at all, not at all as a political figure, but as a spiritual leader. And therefore, I was received as his envoy with great courtesy. And that reception has continued throughout.
One of the prime essentials, I imagine, was gaining the confidence of the people you were talking to. How does one set about that?
Well, I think one needs to remember that wherever you go, people are people and must be respected as such. And because the customs and traditions are different than the customs and traditions that perhaps I'm used to in the United Kingdom, nevertheless, they're valid for the people of the country one's visiting.
But don't those very facts make it all the more fraught for you? You
yes.
could easily cause offence. There can be misunderstandings, different cultures, different religions.
Well, probably it's a question of sensitivity and of looking carefully and recognising that there are differences, but differences to be respected. And also recognising, too, that I was there on a religious and humanitarian mission, seeking to try and pursue what was just and what was right. And justice is universal. It's no, doesn't belong to one particular culture.
The modest, softly spoken Terry Waite. We welcomed another man of God, but one whose approach couldn't possibly have been in sharper contrast. Good God, I get smart. Sure. That rock and roll firecracker, Little Richard, one of the many entertainers who came in to talk to us. His visit was prompted by the publication of his autobiography.
I think that everybody in England and in other parts of the world should read this book because it's a fantastic book. It's the truth that tells how a little poor black boy from Macon, Georgia, a dishwasher, became famous all over the world. You know, when I first came on the scene, it wasn't in the rock and roll. You know, all I heard was moo, and that was from the cow, and I heard the chickens.
But you renounced that fame and a lot of that money to, yes, to go for gospel singing.
That's right, I did. I'm in the ministry now. I'm an evangelist now. I'm an ordained minister. I gave rock and roll up for the Rock of Ages. I became a drug addict. I was a cocaine addict. I was paying $10,000 a month for cocaine. I was on heroin. I was on hashes. I was on whatever would get you high was me. You could just call me, instead of Little Richard, Little High.
That was when you saw the light.
That's right.
Let's turn back the clock a few years before that, to the very beginning. When I read your biography, I felt that Macon, Georgia was a little bit like Catfish Row in George Gershwin's Porgy and Bess. Mm-hmm. Everybody seemed to be very friendly and they
sang, that
gave you a sort of background
of
music.
That's right.
What was it like?
Well, when I was a little boy, you know, it was a guy who used to walk down the streets playing a washboard. We call it a rub board in my hometown, and his name was Bama Lama. And he would be hollering, Bama Lama, woo, you shall be free in the morning. And then another guy would walk down the streets playing the guitar, and a black lady would be over here singing, whoa. Another black lady would sing, woo. Another black lady, woo. Everybody would be just hollering and singing, and I was in the middle. I said, oh, my God, one day I got to do this. Wah, bah, 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 bah.
The ebullient Little Richard Big Sound, just one of several internationally celebrated performers who discussed their lives and careers. Inevitably, during conversation, one has to touch on the way that most of them were immersed in music at a very early age, like opera star Placido Domingo.
Oh, I started to sing all my life. And in the theatre it was about when I was 15, and then in the opera when I was 18.
But of course you've been surrounded by music. Your parents were both involved in a type of theatre that was called
Zarzuela,
which is, yes, a mixture almost of operetta and, yeah, Gilbert and Sullivan, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
All the time, yes, I was involved, and I'm a son of art, and that I enjoyed very much. So I was practically the whole time on the stage, so the stage has been my life.
And you sang in Zarzuela?
Yes, because, of course, listening to my parents, I get very inspired, and I like very much the stage, so when I realize I have a voice, I have to start, you know.
There is in that voice Placido Domingo, for whom London is a second home, but then so it is for a multitude of musicians. From much farther away in New Zealand came the talents of the delightful Dame Kiri Takanawa. As the name suggests, of course, Dame Kiri's origins are Maori. But I wondered, how Maori is she?
I think in my roots I'm very Maori, but I'm very New Zealand as well, because you don't seem to separate too much between the two, because we never had to fall back on our Maoridom to come out of anything from New Zealand. We were New Zealanders and rather proud of it. The New Zealanders themselves were very proud to even to have a teaspoon of Maori in them. But Maori and myself, some say, I don't know, I really don't know, because I think I'm either half or quarter. And somewhere along there, I don't think I'm less than quarter. I don't think I'm more than half.
But don't you know who your parents were?
No, not really, no.
How does that come about?
Well, when I was very, very young, I was adopted by a marvellous couple that I know as my parents. Adoption is really quite a very, I think it's quite a marvellous thing, because it's given me a life that I would never normally have had, being adopted into that family by those marvellous people. And coming out of an environment that maybe I would normally have just been lost as just one of the sort of the neighbourhood kids getting into a lot of trouble. And I had a marvellous opportunity in my very young life.
They did take you into a sort of musical household.
Yeah, yes, they do. But, I mean, when you're young, you don't even notice that. I mean, my own children are surrounded by music and they think, oh, no, she's working again, you know. That was sort of my idea. I sit round at the piano, what for? I want to go out and play. I want to, you know, sort of go on my bike. I want to go fishing. I want to do all the things that young kids don't want to do, is sit inside and play the piano and sing songs.
But did your mother insist you did that?
Oh, yes, she did.
When did you decide that singing would be your future?
Well, I didn't, actually. All along my life, I've sort of just gone along. And my mother decided I would sing. She decided we would move to Auckland to train with a marvellous singing teacher, who, incidentally, I only trained with for about 6 or 7 years. I've since trained with my now-present singing teacher for about, gosh, 16. Would it be 16 years? Easily 16 years. And that's been a marvellous thing, from that thing in New Zealand, from coming from a very small town to going to a slightly larger town, to going to Australia to go for competitions and things, and then finally taking the big step, which my mother did take, and just coming over to England and starting all over again, this great big hard world.
But it certainly paid off. Also from what we lightheartedly call the Antipodes came the writer and critic with that delightfully acerbic pen, Clive James. When the second volume of his autobiography came out during the year, he recalled how he'd arrived in Britain, young, ambitious, and unsuitably dressed.
I had the right clothes for an Australian summer. Unfortunately, it was January in England, and it was snowing, and I was wearing running shorts, Hong Kong thong rubber sandals, T-shirts, stuff like that. I had a suitcase full of this stuff. The customs man went through my collection of Australian clothes. He looked at me and said I was trying to smuggle Hong Kong rubber thongs into Britain.
How soon did you recover from pneumonia?
Oh, after about the first 15 years or so, I started getting a grip. Mm. But this book only covers the first 2 years, when I was really down and out. And I had a plan, and the plan was to do menial tasks by day and write masterpieces at night. But I'd completely underestimated how hard it was to do a menial task. I was exhausted at night. And also, I hadn't realized that I was unfit for menial tasks, and I got fired from job after job. This was just innate lack of capacity and reliability. These are really unreliable memoirs in every sense. The memoirs of an unreliable man.
Washing dishes? What sort of menial tasks were you doing?
Well, I wasn't washing dishes, no. I was. They wouldn't let me do that. I was. I coded market research reports. I did market research questionnaires. I went out into the street with a market research questionnaire, and I asked people whether they wanted the plastic top of their plastic bottle of detergent attached to the plastic bottle by a plastic strap, or separate. And they would give me an answer. Or rather, no one would give me an answer except one nice man who actually answered my questions. And then it turned out he was from Sweden. And he was the only person I'd managed to get to talk to me, so I changed it, and I said he was from Swindon. And that's when I got the idea that if I could change his nationality, I could make up everything. So I started making up these people, and eventually I got caught and had to move on. Always moving on.
If Clive James and Dame Kiri Takanawa felt drawn to Britain, for one BBC correspondent it was the other way about. He felt the irresistible pull of his birthplace, India, although it took Mark Tully some time to get there. After all, he did go via the Garden of Eden.
I did genuinely want to get into the church, and I am still very interested in matters of religion, and I have a great admiration for people who do go into the church. But unfortunately, I was of a rather sociable nature in those days, and I used to spend a lot of time in a pub, perhaps appropriately called the Adam and Eve, just below Lincoln Cathedral. And the Bishop of Lincoln was a very kind man, and he called me into his study, and he said, look, I think that the amount of time you spend in the Adam and Eve as compared with in church or in the library means that you're better out in the world than in the church.
Can't say I blame you, though, because the beer in Lincoln's awfully good, isn't it? We did a programme from there recently. How did you get into the BBC?
Well, I fluked my way in, really. Actually, I was out of a job at the time, and I went to the University Appointments Board, and they said there's a job going in the BBC. It sounded much too high-powered and much too complicated for me. It talked about middle seniority and experienced, and there was I, about 27, and with no experience of anything worthwhile. But somehow I managed to fluke the job, and I entered, of all strange places, in the personnel department.
Did you always want to go back to India? Was it your ambition to be the correspondent, though?
Well, it wasn't actually my ambition to be the correspondent, really. It was my ambition to go back again, a very strong ambition. And when I did get back there, I realised immediately it was the right thing, because I had a very peculiar experience. I arrived off my first long flight, very jet-lagged, and I was in a hotel called Claridge's in New Delhi. I was feeling very tired, a little confused, not quite clear what I'd come there for. And I went out in the veranda, and I smelt the smell of Marley's gardeners cooking their food. And I can assure you there's a complete difference between that sort of food and the sort of food you get in Indian restaurants here. And the smell, that smell of that very spicy food, just brought all my childhood memories back through my mind in one big rush, and I knew then that I'd come to the right country, and I haven't been proved wrong yet.
A happy man, descended from Adam and Eve, or the Adam and Eve in Lincoln. Meanwhile, another of the BBC's correspondents, Mark Brain, had well and truly settled down in Peking, and even found time to get around a little, including taking a journey by train, travelling what they call their soft class.
Service in China's soft class comes with a smile, mugfuls of hot tea, lace tablecloths, and Chinese opera on the train's address system. Alternatively, the radio lady has advice and a few warnings. Keep the train clean, comrades. Don't spit. Keep an eye on your baggage, all delivered in ditty form to the accompaniment of a Sichuan bamboo rattle. Cheerful ditties over the intercom are one of the services offered on Chinese trains. On ours to Chongqing, there was also an on-board official photographer. For about 30 pence, and that's a lot of money for a Chinese, he offered to post your photograph onto you. Little services like this, and not just on the trains, are a new idea in China, where the Communist Party has now decided that a little individual enterprise can brighten up people's lives. But was the photographer doing it just for the money?
Well, it is not as simple as to make money only. There are quite a lot of passengers who have this sort of wish or desire, that is to have some photos taken on the train, since some of them are traveling to this part of the country on business tours, and some of them are on their honeymoon, some of them on, you know, transfers of their jobs and so on and so forth. And as some old people just to celebrate their birthdays on the train. Some of the babies also have their birthdays celebrated here and so on. So they just want to, you know, have some photos taken to mark this occasion. So it is out of the concern of the demands of the passengers that the Chongqing section of the railway administration has decided to start such a business.
How's that for service? And travelling in China by train seems rather more reliable than by making your own way by bicycle, at least if the experience of this man's anything to go by.
We are from Montreal, a group of 12 Canadians, and we intend to spend at least 3 weeks in China, doing at least 2 weeks of bicycling. But right now we've had a little mishap. They have lost 9 of our bicycles.
One of the people Michael Kay spoke to standing on the Great Wall of China. Another was a famous illusionist about to perform a feat to be televised all over the world.
I'm going to try to walk through the Great Wall of China.
And you are David Copperfield?
Yes.
Yes. How are you going to walk through the Great Wall of China?
Very carefully. We won't do it lengthwise. We're going to go through it just because I'd be walking for a long time.
How wide is the wall?
About 25 feet.
But this is television. Surely it's an optical illusion.
Well, it's not a camera trick, certainly. There's a live audience that we have here that's going to witness it. And in fact, we brought a Luma crane, which is a crane which can go from one side of the wall to the other, so we can do the entire illusion and show it to the home viewer all in one shot, so that they can see it without a cut or anything like that, but where suspicions of camera trickery will be dispelled.
What's the risk of failure? A bloody nose?
No, in fact, we heard about this monastery in Tibet where they found the bones of a man embedded in a wall. His entire skeleton was stuck inside the wall, running in and out of each brick. And the only explanation they could think of was that a monk had discovered a form of meditation that allowed him to pass through objects. And the experts aren't sure whether he did this often or whether it was his first attempt. It was certainly his last attempt.
Even the Great Wall can't stop David Copperfield. I suppose you could easily mistake for Chinese the unusual language of entertainer Stanley Unwin, if you weren't a little wiser, of course. In fact, it's as English as he is, even if it is rather different to the everyday straightforward English that most of us use.
Once a polytaito. You may think that doesn't sound quite right. But believe me, once a polytaito it is. And in this case, it was Goldilocks. Goldilocks trickly how in the early mordy, and she falloped down the steps. Oh, unfortunate for cracking of the eggers and the sheeps and the buttery, full falollop and graze her kneeclappers. So she had a vasalubrious, rubby on and a quick healy huff, and that was that.
John Tidmarsh wanted to know from Stanley Unwin how his Unwinese had come about.
Well, I had a thirst for languages, John. I joined the Polytechnic to try and find about these languages and discovered that my English really wasn't good enough to master them. So I took it up again, so to speak, you know. It was then that I was aware that very few people bother to speak it properly, and this made me cross at times until I realised I was being rather snobbish. And I admonished my mother one day because she made up a verb to express her feelings. Shall I tell you about that?
Do.
Well, she came home with a badly bruised knee, and I said, "Oh, Mother, what happened?" She said, "Well, I fell off in front of a tram." I said, "Mother, there is no verb to falollop." She said, "Well, I falollop and I've grazed my knee clapper." You know, she was a bit of a malaprop, and when she was excited, these words used to tumble out.
When did you first use Unwinese, then?
Well, I used it with my children at bedtime. But, you know, they don't recall much of this for the simple reason they weren't listening, and that's why I did it. You see? You know, I did it for a joke. One night I said, "Well, now tonight it begins wonderfully Taito and it's called Goldilocks." Well, two of them never took any notice, and the other one, the youngest one, said, "Hey, just a minute, Dad, that's not quite right, you know."
I know also, Stanley, that you used Unwinese to very good effect on a number of occasions when you were still working for the BBC as a recording engineer, at least once when I was out with you.
Yeah, I don't recall what actually happened on that occasion, but I do recall a couple of others. I know I was with a BBC producer trying to get into an airfield to get a radio newsreel story, and the chap wouldn't let me in, you know. The commissioner said, "No, you've got the wrong sticker. Well, you know the urgency of getting a news story, don't you?"
Absolutely.
Right. Well, I said to him, "It's as much as yours or mine, a crust of cheese for work it. This VIP appeal is right in the half-hour's room, and I want to get through for it, Fold." "Oh, why didn't you say so?" he said, and opened the gate and let me in.
And that's the way to do it. Stanley Unwin, the man who'd have Professor Higgins and any other linguistic perfectionists turning in their graves. Why can't the English learn to speak? And during the year, we brought you an entire outlook on location from that very spot where the good professor first met the Cockney flower seller, Eliza Doolittle, Covent Garden.
No, moved quite so quickly. Wow, there's an enthusiastic response from the audience there, who are seated all round the act that was just playing Tony and Stodd, known to me secretly as Tony Aldridge and Cliff Stoddard. I'm not quite sure whether I ought to call you lads buskers. Is that a derogatory term these days?
Well, we're street musicians, but we also do cabaret work and other things, so it's a good place to rehearse shows on the street.
Tony, can anybody amble into the piazza and play, or at least the West End of it, or are there sort of restrictions?
There are restrictions in the West End. In Covent Garden itself, there are two main pitches where you're allowed to play if you get a licence from the relevant bodies. It's not difficult to get hold of. Mainly, the most difficult thing is the audience.
Difficult in what way?
If you've got a very strong act, you get a good audience. But if your act isn't very strong, there's no point going down here.
Well, my logic tells me in that case, Starr, that you've got a pretty strong act from the way they were just reacting.
Well, thanks very much.
Well, we're going to delight the public once again, or at least Tony and Starr, because you're about to burst into music again. What's it going to be this time, lads?
Cole Porter's song called It's All Right By Me.
Off you go, then. Violins on fire. In fact, it was a blazing day, one of the all-too-rare brilliantly hot days of summer in London. But it was back here in the studio that Britain's highly successful black comedian Lenny Henry, I think, blushed when I reminded him about the early days of his career on television.
I hang my head. It was really weird because there was I, 16 years old, and to get experience, they put me in the Black and White Minstrel Show, which, for those of you who don't know, is a lot of white people who put makeup on their face to make them appear to look as if they are black, and then singing Stephen Foster songs and anything, really. And at one point, I had to compare the show. So, first of all, it was like something out of Blazing Saddles. First of all, there's all these white people blacked up singing, "Oh, Dem Golden Slippers," and then the real thing coming out and introducing the show. It was very, very strange, and I went through a weird paradox in my mind for about 5 years while I was doing that show.
They didn't even think at
any time. Didn't know where I was. They used to come into my advice. They wanted to be, "Lenny, how do you do it? Please, just tell me how can I be a real black man? I just cannot deal with this. Please tell me, and I'll just try my best to live."
Whilst they were busy blacking up, nobody suggested you ought to white up.
No. Well, they did, but they were beaten over the head with a stick.
I think most people will have detected an accent of some kind by now. Now, I'd know immediately it was somewhere from the English Midlands, but you can pinpoint it rather more accurately.
I'm from Dudley in the West Midlands, which is 9 miles outside of Birmingham. It's an industrial town. It's known as the Black Country because of the... apparently, if you looked at it from about 10 miles away, you could just see this big layer of dust settling on all the houses over there. I lived there for most of my life. I moved out about 5 years ago because I got married and I live in London now. But it's still home to me. It's great. All the people talk like that. All the words fall off.
Where did the family originally come from?
Jamaica, St. Anne's. St. Anne's District. Does this program go out to Jamaica?
Oh, yes, indeed.
What happened? You all right, though? Scene? Or something like that.
Couldn't have failed to have heard that. It probably blew our transmitters off. When you were young and you were being brought up in Dudley, was there any sense of your feeling different at all because your parents were West Indian and you were black?
Well, at the time, there weren't that many black families around in the Midlands. But at the beginning, it wasn't a big deal. You know, I was just Lenny, and that was it. I didn't sort of realise that there was something going on until I was about 8, 9.
And I suppose prejudices are more easily broken down between young people, aren't they?
Well, kids, definitely. Kids, that's where it's got to start, with kids, because kids just don't care about colour, really.
Mary Midlander, Lenny Henry, recalling his childhood. And on the subject of children, Liv Ullman, actress and ambassador for UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, told us about a recent trip she'd made to Central America.
Not only in Colombia, but in many, many countries in the world, little children live and survive on the street. And I met some of them in Bogota, the capital of Colombia, and they were like 6, 7, 8 years old. And they told me they were hungry. And so we went to a really little dingy cafe, and they wanted chicken wings. And a big plate with chicken wings came. But every time one little child took a chicken wing, the wing would be offered first to me. And all the time, you know, there would be a little hand on my lap or a hand around my waist. And one little child would pretend he was tired so, you know, the head could just casually fall down on my shoulder. The need of somebody grown up, somebody warm. And then when the meal was over, they said they wanted to go back to their home, which was the street corner. And all night they had been dragging this little dirty sack that turned out to be their blanket, because the nights are cold, also in Latin America. And they had hidden very well a piece of cardboard paper that was their bed. And three little boys lie down on this cardboard paper, and they wanted to be tucked in, since the grown-up was still there. And I tucked them in this dirty sack. And that's when they did this really incredible thing. They stretched up their arms, and they wanted a good night kiss, like my child did, like every other child I've seen in my part of the world. And I think when these arms came up, that's when I realized that to be a parent isn't only to be a parent to our own children. Parenthood includes all children. They shouldn't be lying on cardboard paper. We can afford a bed and a possibility of life for them, wherever they live.
Another actress who takes a close interest in what's happening in third world countries is Glenda Jackson. She had vivid memories of her visit to Ethiopia, where she made a film for the British-based relief organisation Oxfam. John Titmarsh asked if she'd been recognised there.
People in Addis, yes, some people in Addis knew me, but not in any of the provinces, really. Except all the kids call you sister-sister because you're a European female, and of course their experience of European females has been the sisters of the various aid agencies, so they're always hoping you've got an Oxfam biscuit tucked in your back pocket.
Mm. Most of them probably hadn't seen a cinema, let alone a film star.
Oh, no, no.
Are you planning to return?
I would like to.
At one time, I think you wanted to be a social worker, didn't you? I mean, is it the sort of experience that makes you say, well, I'm going to change my career entirely, this is what I'd like?
Well, I've always had a long-term contingency plan, but I would like to do... I'd like to join VSO, you know, Voluntary Service Overseas. And this is a plan that has to be fairly long-term, because I have to wait until I've got my son off my hands, if you see what I mean, get him to university and whatever. And VSO are very good, because they will take people up to the age of 65. You can trot off to one of the developing countries and do your 2 years. And I would very much like to do that. But what qualifications an old actress has that would be helpful to a developing country, I'm hard-pressed to know. So I would have to get some kind of education first, some kind of qualification, so that if I did go out, I would be helpful as opposed to a burden.
Glenda Jackson. The drought and famine in various parts of Africa and the appalling human suffering it caused was much in all our minds during 1985. At the beginning of the year, reporter Nick Worrell went to see conditions for himself in Sudan.
By far the major problem now for Sudan is what's happening in the east, and I toured the camps up the east, some 400 to 500 miles east of Khartoum, along the Ethiopian border or the Eritrean border, and there something like 2 to 3, sometimes 4,000 people a day are crossing in from Ethiopia, destitute, very little to wear, and it's very cold at night. They've sold their animals on the way, they've sold what jewellery they have, they sold their ploughs before they left, and they're arriving virtually penniless. They're arriving hungry, they're arriving cold, and they're also arriving sick. And this is now a major problem for Sudan to cope with.
You were saying a moment ago that water is obviously one problem, and that means health is also a problem.
Yes, the health of people who come in is often quite good when they first arrive because they've been assisted across. But their health, in fact, after a day or two or 3 days in the camp, deteriorates very quickly. They're malnourished. They don't get enough to eat, by and large. The food they're getting is not supplemented. The grain is not supplemented as much as it should be, with milk and vitamins and fruit and things like that. And so they do deteriorate fast, particularly, of course, the children, who need constant intake. And the mortality rate among children is now pretty high. It seems to vary from place to place, from about 10 through 20 to, in some places, 40 a day, children dying.
Nick Worrell, eyewitness to the plight of refugees in Sudan. As the year drew to its close, we asked you to write into us, giving us your nominee for the Person of the Year. And you did write in. Thank you very much. Anne Theroux's been counting the votes. Anne?
Well, we had hundreds of letters and a lot of very varied nominations. Unfortunately, I haven't got time to go through the whole list, so let's just take the top six. Among these were Terry Waite, the Archbishop of Canterbury's special envoy, who we heard earlier in the programme, United States President Ronald Reagan, Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, and in third place, Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev. A listener in Liberia gives this reason for nominating Mr. Gorbachev, which I think others agreed with. His moderateness makes him different from his predecessors. In second place, with a very large number of votes, is David Lange, Prime Minister of New Zealand. And again, one letter will have to stand for all the rest. This person says, I nominate him for the stand he made against nuclear weapons, despite pressures against him from more powerful countries. So David Lange was second, but the overall winner, by a huge majority, is, well, let me quote a letter from Tanzania. I nominate that British pop singer for his great job of organising the two televised concerts in London and New York, aimed at collecting funds for the starving people of Africa, Ethiopia in particular. Unfortunately, I've forgotten his name, but I'm sure you know who I mean. Well, of course, he meant Bob Geldof.
Flattered beyond belief. I mean, if the entire planet has voted me Man of the Year. I was in Kenya once on one of those safari things, and I was miles away from anywhere, and I turned on the World Service, and I heard one of our records, one of the Boomtown Rats records, and here I was in the middle of Africa, and our record was coming out, and it was a brilliant moment, you know. And if all those people around the world have voted me Man of the Year, then I'm suitably humbled.
Universally admired Bob Geldof, who brought together the talents of a legion of pop superstars to raise millions of pounds for aid to Africa. And it's with the sound of Africa that we leave you. Music from Uganda, brought to Britain by a Ugandan children's choir. With a peace agreement towards the end of this year, 1986 could mark a turning point in their home country. To them, and of course to you, wherever you might be, this is Colin Hamilton and all the Outlook team wishing you a happy, peaceful new year.